Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. About half of Americans take multivitamins, vitamin supplements. So it was big news this month when two new studies came out with headlines pointing to dangers. People started looking twice at their bottle of multivitamins, questioning their "does my body good" ritual of popping supplements with breakfast. This hour On Point, the latest controversy over vitamin supplements and whether they can hurt you. Later in this hour, we'll talk about the new recommendation that boys be vaccinated for HPV. But first, to vitamins. Joining me from New York is Sharon Begley, science editor for Newsweek and The Daily Beast. Her recent article in The Daily Beast was headlined, "Will Supplements Kill You?" Sharon, you've got our attention. Thanks for joining us.
Hello, Tom.
So, kill you? Where does this come from?
As you mentioned at the top, this reflected a couple of recent studies published this month. And one was a huge study, which actually had been going on for a very long time, in which men were randomly assigned to either take 400 IUs of vitamin E or not. And the rationale for the study is that there had been so-called observational studies in which people just, you know, made their own choice whether they were going to take vitamin E or not. And it looked, there were some hints that maybe that would be helpful for reducing the risk of prostate cancer. So this was a much more rigorous study. Again, half the men were assigned to take vitamin E and half the men were not. And it's now been more than 10 years, and unfortunately, the bottom line is that the men taking 400 IUs of vitamin E daily had a 17% greater likelihood of developing prostate cancer over the next 7 years.
Wow.
You know, I should quickly say here that whenever I write a story like this, I always tell my readers, don't believe one single study. You know, studies can be wrong.
Right.
Unfortunately, in the case of vitamin E and vitamin supplements more generally, this is only the latest in a very long line of studies showing, A, that they're not helpful, and B, that they might be actively harmful.
I'm sure that one got the attention of a lot of men thinking about prostate, thinking they'd done themselves good with vitamin E for a long time. Also a big study of women out of the University of Minnesota and more. Tell us about that one, Sharon.
And this one also was, again, you know, thousands of people. Again, you should believe that kind of study more than you do one that has, you know, a couple of dozen participants.
Okay.
And this, too, looked at vitamin supplements. This was much more general. It looked at all supplements, and it looked at all causes of mortality. And there, again, the bottom line was very similar. Women who took daily vitamin supplements had a higher overall risk of dying within the period of the study than those who did not. So, you know, the first thing you might say in response to that, well, you know, maybe people who are sick or sicker, they're the ones who take vitamins. So, of course, their health is going to be worse.
Okay.
But and that's very logical. But in both cases, the scientists made sure that that was not the reason they controlled for the initial health of the people who were participating. So it really does look, and again, because these are not the only two studies, it really is starting to look as if taking high-dose supplements, and I'll get back to that in a second, is not helpful to your health. And the reason I say high-dose, vitamin E, the RDA is 22 IUs, the units there.
Recommended daily allowance.
Recommended daily allowance, exactly.
And IUs is what? International units.
International units.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. 22. And again, in the study, the men were taking 400. And in fact, half of the men in this country over 60 take 400 IUs of vitamin E a day.
So we've all gotten into this kind of, if a little is good, more must be better, and down the hatch we go. But they're also looking, I mean, they looked at multivitamins, and they found this. And this was among 38,000 women they saw a higher risk there, as I understand it. And also looking at a bunch of other supplements, found higher odds of death associated with vitamin B, folic acid, iron, magnesium, zinc, copper. I mean, it starts to sound like the panel on the side of the vitamin bottle, sure.
Well, it really does. And, you know, people need to ask themselves whether they are getting what the vitamins and nutrients that they need from, you know, this old category that we quaintly call food. Again, figure out what the RDAs are. And if you are eating a basically healthy diet, you know, which doesn't mean 18 carrots a day and a half a gallon of orange juice, but just, you know, the kind of diet recommended by the food plate that's now been rolled out by the U.S. Department of Agriculture. In all likelihood, you're getting the amount of vitamins and other minerals and other micronutrients that are required for good health. As you just said, Tom, we seem to believe that more is better, but in fact, we're seeing that more may be harmful.
But we don't come to that daily intake by accident. I mean, these things are packaged and sold in a certain way, with certain volume, you know, in each pill that suggests, here you go, off to the races.
Yeah, and, you know, we've all been sucked into that. And partly it's because the kind of information that we get, especially on labels and, you know, from the manufacturer's websites, they have essentially been given a blank check, a 20-year-old law about health foods and supplements allows them to make claims that do not have to pass muster with the Food and Drug Administration. So there are some limitations, but, you know, when you walk into a health food store and something is labeled as good for prostate, good for heart, good for whatever, those are lightly, if at all, regulated.
Sure. Let me ask you about another thing that people have paid a lot of attention to in recent years. That is antioxidants that would go after free radicals in the blood, we were told, and sort of knock out cancer-causing agents. What about that whole raft of products?
Well, it makes perfect sense in principle for exactly the reasons that you just listed. And that principle is that as the body goes, you know, does normal metabolism, it produces supposedly dangerous compounds called free radicals, and those can interfere with your DNA, perhaps causing mutations that will lead to cancer. It can ravage the inside of blood vessels, possibly leading to cardiovascular disease. So again, on paper, anything that would mop up, that would, you know, sweep away those free radicals, looked like it should be good for our health. So two things have since emerged. One is that something that acts as a free radical in a test tube does not necessarily do so once you've eaten it and digested it and it, you know, goes throughout your bloodstream. So there's something called an ORAC score, O-R-A-C, which purports to indicate how strong an antioxidant some particular food is, you know, cherries or tea or whatever.
Blueberries, all the other things we're chowing down.
The list goes on. Yep. And there, again, the bottom line is just because it does something in a test tube doesn't mean it will do the same thing in your body. But even more worrisome has been the recognition, and this is just the last couple of years, you know what? There's a reason that the body has these free radicals, and it might not be a mistake. Instead, it turns out that some of these compounds, yeah, they might not be good for all of your cells, but they're also not good for malignant cells or premalignant cells. Free radicals are one way that the immune system attacks precancerous cells. It's one way the immune system attacks viruses and other invaders. You know, evolution has had millions of years to get this right. And for us then to just start monkeying around with it, it turns out, might not be such a good idea. So, in fact, there have been studies showing that, for instance, beta-carotene, one of the, you know, the favorite antioxidants, actually increases the risk of lung cancer, and now we're understanding why that might be.
Boy, this is hard to take on board when you think of everything that goes on every day. I mean, 150 million Americans or more taking supplements. But we'll march on down this list. Vitamin C, good old vitamin C, Sharon, which so many people take to, you know, ward off colds, and surely that's a good thing. And there again, we come back to kind of disturbing headline. I don't know the details, but what do you see in that latest research?
Well, there, you know, they may protect cancer cells for the reasons that we were just discussing.
I mean, not get rid of cancer cells, but actually protect the cancer cells? So
because,
in other words, encourage it?
Because the immune system, again, there is some immune system attack on cancerous and precancerous cells. And too much vitamin C, again, we're not saying don't, you know, every drink another glass of orange juice. But we're talking about mega doses here. That may override the natural immune system's ability to attack cancer cells.
What's a mega dose? I mean, it's easy to buy pills off the shelf that's, I don't know, 500 or 1,000.
500, yeah.
Is that a mega dose?
Yes. Consult the RDA, and I don't have it in front of me for vitamin C. But if I recall correctly, 6 ounces of orange juice gives you your total daily required intake of vitamin C.
Sharon, you report the Council for Responsible Nutrition, and this is the trade group of the supplement industry, all these vitamins, railing against this one big study from in the Archives of Internal Medicine, saying it was part of a, quote, a recent drive to combine political agendas with what should be pure science. Is there politics driving the research results and the way they're presented that we're seeing here on vitamins?
I was trying to understand what they meant by that when they were explaining their concerns about this study. And what they seem to object to, what they're calling political, are the pieces of advice from the scientists who say you don't need to take multivitamins, you don't need to take single vitamin supplements to maintain a healthy life. All you need is to eat right. And the supplement industry seems to take the message, just eat healthy foods, as a political statement. You know, I guess the word political covers a lot of ground, but that seems to be what they object to.
What about on the, is it possible? You know, we've got a locavore movement and a sort of organic movement. I mean, is there a, I don't know, a political movement against supplements, or do you see it simply as that's what science is saying?
I vote for option B, and the reason I say that is, I mean, just look at the vitamin E study. The scientists who started that actually started out as believers, and that reflects, as I said a few minutes ago, the fact that just simple observational studies had suggested that vitamin E might be protective against prostate cancer. So they said, okay, here's an interesting hypothesis, you know, weak evidence, because that's what observational studies give you. Let's do a really rigorous trial, and let's, by God, prove that vitamin E can protect against prostate cancer. So if anything, they were, you know, rooting for that outcome, and they were quite not only surprised, but when I talked to a few of them, disappointed that they got the opposite.
Sharon Begley, science editor at Newsweek and The Daily Beast. Her recent article in The Beast was, Will Supplements Kill You? Sharon, you've got our attention, and now more than that, we appreciate your time today.
Thank you, Tom.
Do you pop them every morning? A multivitamin C, D, E, B12, a fistful? We'll dig on in. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about the latest debate over vitamins and vitamin supplements, whether your daily ritual down the hatch might do more harm than good. It is not hard to hear the advice that, yes, take them. Here's a little bit from January 2010 episode of the Dr. Oz show. Surgeon-turned-talk show host Dr. Mehmet Oz talked about the essential vitamins that all women need.
It's a brand new year, and I'm setting you straight on one of the most important but confusing health issues out there, how to choose the right vitamins. Well, you're never going to have that problem again, because today I'm revealing the critical vitamins every woman absolutely must have. This, of course, is what a multivitamin looks like. And this little pill, of course, ideally you take half in the morning and half in the evening, because you always want to divide your vitamins, half morning, half evening, is what you get in a multivitamin bottle. You also want to talk about omega-3 fats and about what a little bit of extra vitamin D. That's sort of the ideal constellation. It's three pills.
Three pills, multivitamins, must, absolutely must have, says Dr. Oz, and here we are trying to figure it all out. Let's expand our circle and dive on in. With us now from New York is Marion Nessel, professor of nutrition, food studies, and public health at New York University, author of Food Politics, How the Food Industry Influences Nutrition and Health. She blogs at foodpolitics.com and writes a monthly Food Matters column for the San Francisco Chronicle. Marion Nessel, thanks very much for being with us.
Oh, glad to be here.
And with me from Boston is Walter Willett, professor of epidemiology and nutrition, chair of the Department of Nutrition at the Harvard School of Public Health. He is author of Eat, Drink, and Be Healthy, the Harvard Medical School Guide to Healthy Eating. Walter Willett, thank you so much for joining us.
Good to be with you.
So first to you, Professor Willett. You hear all these headlines. You heard our conversation right there with Sharon Begley. Millions and millions of Americans have vitamins in the kitchen cabinet and are sitting there wondering, Am I wrong to have been taking these? Here's headlines that seem to suggest that they have been wrong. What do you say?
The area is really complicated, and unfortunately some of those headlines really over-sensationalized these stories. The answer is that you clearly can take too much of some vitamins, and they can be harmful. And you can say that about almost everything in your natural diet. You can overdo almost anything. And the real issues get down to what specific vitamin we're talking about, who is going to be taking it, and the dose. Those are all important, and there's definitely not a clear answer vitamins are good or vitamins are bad. I would like to go back to some of what Sharon said. She really didn't give us the right story. The reason for this trial that was just reported on vitamin E in prostate cancer was not observational studies showing benefit. In fact, we published a study showing no benefit. The primary reason was another randomized trial in Finland supported by our National Cancer Institute showing a significant benefit for vitamin E supplements in prostate cancer. And that was the reason to see if that finding could be confirmed. They did use a larger dose in this new study. And even this new study was not at all clear because the vitamin E alone group got had this increase in diagnosed prostate cancer, but there was another group that got vitamin E with selenium, and that did not have an elevated risk of prostate cancer. Also, another very large study was reported not long ago, the Physicians' Health Study, and their vitamin E had no adverse effect on prostate cancer
risk. But if they've got one group that has a higher prostate rate and one group that doesn't, I mean, if it's a jump ball, why take the pill?
Well, I think there is pretty good evidence that the pill does not reduce risk of prostate cancer. But I think the likelihood that there's harm is actually pretty low, given you've got half of one study showing increase, another study showing a decrease, another study showing no effect. And those are all large randomized trials.
What about this big study of women on multivitamins? And they tended to be healthier than the norm at the outset, and then we end up with a higher death rate, is what we're told.
Yes, that study was way overplayed. This multiple vitamin increase was so small that we would, I think, in epidemiology, almost never make any firm conclusion.
You mean 6% more likely to die over a 19-year period? I don't know, but it doesn't sound like an argument for multivitamins.
No, it's not. But the study itself was really weak in multiple ways. First of all, total mortality, it sounds simple, but that's actually the most difficult endpoint to look at because people just don't go along and then drop dead. They usually become ill sometimes, especially this was a study of older people, decline for reasons, their health declines for reasons that are not all crystal clear, and they may go on for some years declining, trying to do things that make them feel better, taking vitamins. And this study, Sharon said they did some things that tried to deal with that, but they acknowledged that it was very possible that they did not adequately address that. Normally a study, a well-done study, would exclude people who were ill to begin with. They didn't exclude people, even with known illness, and there's a lot of unknown, undiagnosed illness in elderly people.
But they said the healthier women, and this is a lot of women, 38,000 over nearly two decades, the healthier women at the outset were those who ended up with the highest rate of mortality.
Well, there's a complex, it is complicated. On average, the people who take supplements tend to be healthier, but there are a mix of people who are taking supplements because they're ill, and they couldn't separate that very well. It's complicated. It's much better to look at not mortality, but look earlier in the progress and look at, say, risks of heart disease and cancer and those kinds of things. There's not as much what we call reverse causation, people taking supplements because of their disease when you do that kind of study. Mm. And their studies have generally found with longer-term use that there is a lower risk of coronary heart disease, some studies showing lower risk of stroke, and some studies showing lower risk of some cancers, particularly colorectal cancer, but not until after 15 or 20 years of use. I think one really important point here is that most of the trials that have been done are just far too short to realistically look at potential benefits.
But in fairness, both of these are very long studies, well beyond your 15-year. Walter Willett, stand by, if you would. Marion Nessel, I mean, we're entirely open to the notion that there's all kinds of sophisticated subtleties when it comes to biomedical research. On the other hand, you look at these outcomes, you're not a medical doctor, and you're left shaking your head and wondering, you know, am I wasting my time? Am I even hurting myself with a load of vitamins every day, Marion?
Well, I just find this whole thing absolutely hilarious because this is an example of the supplement industry reaping what it sowed 20 years ago. 20 years ago, the dietary supplement industry insisted that Congress deregulate dietary supplements, and Congress did. And in the law that was passed in 1994, Congress said, let's set up a research institute. Let's do research on dietary supplements. And, of course, as the research has proceeded, The research not only doesn't show any benefit from dietary supplements in general, but it shows the possibility of harm. I'm not big on the harm idea, but I think the research is very clear that on average these things don't do any good.
I mean,
people are much better off eating food.
It was Senator Orrin Hatch, this was 17 years ago or so, allowed supplement manufacturers to make health claims for their products with no need for federal regulators to okay them. Do you think there's been a big overpromise here, Marion?
Oh, absolutely. And right after the Dietary Supplement Act passed, which, by the way, was written by the supplement industry, sales increased enormously. And then as these studies have been coming out one after another, sales of the supplements at issue have gone down, and they're very upset about it. The Council for Responsible Nutrition's job is to promote supplement sales. And really, supplements get to say on them, they get to make claims that foods aren't allowed to make. There have been all kinds of studies of the contents of supplements showing that they don't always have in them what they say they have in them. I think you're taking a risk when you take a supplement because you don't really know what's in it.
But what about, for example, vitamin D? People have said, there's just not enough sunshine in some parts of the world. You need more vitamin D than people get sitting in a cubicle, Marion.
You can get so much, vitamin D is a hormone. It's not really a vitamin. And you can get so much of it just by being in the sun once in a while. It doesn't even take that long to do it. Walter may disagree with me on that, but I think there are real issues about the current craze about taking vitamin D supplements.
Walter, let's look at that one, if we may. Vitamin D, a lot of people taking it out there. How about it, Walter?
Sure, yes. I think the evidence is very good that there are benefits, and there are, in a meta-analysis of randomized trials, there was a reduction in fracture risk, but the old RDA of 400 IUs wasn't enough that you had to take 700 or 800 to show the reduction in fracture risk. That is actually quite well established.
Bone fracture you're talking about? Fracture
right,
risk?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Right. And to just say go out in the sun, there is definitely hazard if you do it improperly, if you aren't very careful, from increased skin cancer risk that can be fatal. So it's not just because it's natural that it's safe. And we live a life where it looks like the majority of Americans do not get adequate amounts of vitamin D. We work inside. We live in cold places. We're here in Boston and in New York as well, where there isn't much sunshine much of the year. We put on clothes. We put on sunscreen. And we really do block off our connection. And I would like to point out that there are some areas where there are very clear benefits of vitamins. And we should not forget those in women, premenopausal women, folic acid supplements, which are part of a multiple vitamin, reduce the most serious form of birth defects by about 70%. And that's pretty major. There is a recommendation by the Centers for Disease Control that women who might possibly become pregnant should take a folic acid supplement.
Could you fulfill that need simply by, I don't know what, eating more Swiss chard or broccoli?
You probably could.
And I just throw those out. I have no idea where folic acid comes from.
Right. If you eat a really super good diet, you can get enough probably. But some people actually need some extra because there's about 15% of our population that genetically does need some more folate. But the point is that only 3% of the American population actually achieves the dietary guidelines goal, and we're not talking about 15 servings of fruits and vegetables. That's a low bar to meet those guidelines. There's also a high percentage of premenopausal women who are deficient in iron because of regular menstrual cycles. And I think that's an interesting point because the dietary guidelines say eat more red meat. They recognize this problem. They said eat more red meat. And there's very strong evidence that eating more red meat has adverse effects. There's higher risk of coronary heart disease, higher risk of type 2 diabetes. So just getting it from your food doesn't mean that that's automatically safe.
Marion, if I may bring that piece to you, only 3% of Americans, Professor Willett says, meet the dietary guidelines goal. In that case, are vitamins the sooner the better?
That may be true, but the recommended dietary allowances are set very high. People in, I mean, a lot of this is based on dietary surveys where, I don't know how to put this nicely, people forget or underestimate what they're eating.
You mean they actually eat six more servings of vegetables a day than they count?
Well,
I doubt that.
I think people eat more than they think they do.
Marianne, they tend to overreport healthy foods. If anything, they're overreporting their adherence to the guidelines.
I fear that may be true.
I mean, we're going to get into scientific arguments now that are kind of arcane, but I'm always
impressed. It's all about science, Marianne. You can't ignore the science.
Well,
but I'm always impressed that dietary surveys report that people are eating very, very low numbers of calories for the weight that they're carrying, and that's even true of your studies, Walt. Your nurses are reporting a level of calorie intake that couldn't possibly be supporting their body weight.
But maybe it's Twinkies they're not reporting.
You just don't know what that means. You don't know whether it's systematic or whether, as Walt says, they're overestimating healthy foods and underestimating unhealthy foods. You just don't know that.
Take folic acid, Marianne. I mean, to prevent birth defects sounds like a very worthy goal. Would you
And if you look at the history of birth defects in the United States, they were declining by about 50%. Or by a very significant percentage every 4 or 5 years before folate was introduced into the grains, and they've continued to drop at about the same rate they were dropping before that came in. And I've seen a lot of studies lately that are raising concerns about overuse of folate. I don't think that any vitamin separately is something that we should be taking without giving it a great deal of consideration.
Look at the whole diet right there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one of the things that happens in food is that the nutrients are balanced, or they've evolved, or they're there in reasonable proportions. And what you really want is you want people eating a variety of foods with a lot of fruits and vegetables.
Let me bring my callers in, if I may, Mary and Walter. Dean in Evansville, Indiana. Dean, you're on the air, my friend.
Hello, yes. I was just wanting to say that over 6 months ago, I started a vitamin regimen myself. I take a multivitamin every day, and then I take an extra 500 milligrams of vitamin C, and then I started a heavy water regimen. And I have never felt better in my life. I was usually sickly. I have a bad immune system, and I have other health problems. And I haven't gotten sick in the last 6 months. I feel better than I ever have. And I'm just wondering if a lot of the results that they're getting is actually coming from not from these vitamins, but from our food, because they do so much to our food with hormones and injections and pesticides and things like that. And not only our food, but our environment, our air that we breathe and things like that.
Dean, let us pick it right there. The break's coming up. Marianne, Dean wants to turn away from food. He said it's a mess. He feels better on a whole lot of water plus multivitamins and vitamin C.
Well, I don't think there's any question that people feel better when they take vitamins. They really do. The question is whether they feel better because of the vitamins or because of something else that's going on. Hard to know.
You say get it from food, but, you know, he looks at our food supply and you hear his distrust.
Well, I think there's a lot of you that it's quite possible to eat healthfully in the American food supply. You have to pick and choose, and it's nice if you have enough money.
If you have enough money, Walter, do you see a problem in the food supply that should turn people like Dean toward vitamins to supplement or instead of?
Well, I don't think it should be instead of aiming for a healthy diet. I think everyone would agree that the primary objective should be to have a healthy diet. But I think we have to be realistic, too. I mean, Marianne said, it's nice to have enough money. The problem is that a huge part of our population doesn't have enough money. In many places, healthy foods are just not available. I think that's one of the reasons why only 3% of the people are meeting dietary goals.
Well, we're trying to sort out the latest headlines on vitamins, multivitamins, vitamin supplements. Walter Willett, please stand by. Marianne Nessel, I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking about the latest scrap over vitamins and vitamin supplements in your diet, in your daily ritual, and whether they're for better or worse. Lots of response online here. What Josh says, Michael Pollan says it best in Food Rules, be the kind of person who takes supplements, then skip the supplements. Seth says, get your vitamins from your food and from the sun. That's how nature designed it. Michigan writes, the typical American overeats so damn much that vitamin deficiencies are unlikely to be a problem. We'll ask about that. Kathy in Lexington, Massachusetts. Kathy, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thank you. I was thrilled to hear this because I have a back and forth with a friend who sells Juice Plus, which is a supplement.
Is it vitamin enhanced juice?
It's a pill.
Oh, okay. What do I know?
The vitamins are extracted from organic fruits and vegetables.
Okay.
And you take the pill.
Okay.
Her daughter was at my house, and I was employing everyone to eat broccoli, and she said, I don't have to eat vegetables because I take Juice Plus. And that bothered me.
Right. She takes the pill. Let us take it to Walter Willett, Kathy. Walter, what do you say to that story?
Yeah, I think, it's pretty clear that a pill is not a substitute for broccoli. We clearly have to put on the front of the burner healthy foods. But again, there are some areas where foods are not likely or may not for many people fill our nutritional needs in the way that we now come to appreciate as necessary. I already mentioned that folic acid supplements, proven in randomized double-blind trials in many studies around the world, do have a major benefit for reducing serious birth defects. Also, after age 50, we don't absorb B12 from our food very well. Mm. We do absorb it much better in the form that it's in a vitamin supplement, and that's why the U.S. dietary guidelines actually do recommend supplements for over people age 50, specifically vitamin B12, which you can get in a multiple vitamin. We already talked about not getting enough vitamin D in the vast majority of the American population.
And our listener in Michigan who says, we eat so much, surely there's enough nutrition in there.
Well, the problem is the vast majority of what we're eating is junk, and there's not much nutrition there. There's a huge amount of calories in there, and that's part of the problem.
Marion, what are you heterodox on this? What about B12? If we don't process it as well as we age, would you take a B12 supplement, Marion?
Well, I think, I don't have any trouble with people taking low levels of supplements. You know, one a day is fine, and if it makes you feel better, it's reasonable nutrition insurance. What I'm not seeing is large evidence of clinical nutrient deficiency in the population. In a way, I agree with the person who's concerned about how much people are eating. Somewhere in all of that, you're going to be picking up the nutrients that you need, and you don't know much. And you don't need much. Partly it's very difficult to induce nutrient deficiencies in people who eat enough calories. It can be done, but you really have to eat a terrible, terrible diet in order to do that. And the key to eating healthfully is to eat a variety of different kinds of foods and not too much so that you gain too much weight.
Let's go to Roger in Amesbury, Massachusetts.
It's really not any more complicated than that.
Yeah, we got it. Roger, you're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I take fish oil with vitamin E my doctor had suggested I do for a condition I have, and I was just wondering if anybody has done any, double crossover studies on...
When you put those two together,
fish oil and E, and vitamin E.
Yeah, Walter Willett, fish oil, I guess, to thin the blood a little bit, and vitamin E. What about when you put them together?
Well, the fish oil actually in randomized double-blind trials has been shown to reduce sudden cardiac death, and that can be very important, especially if someone is not eating much fish. Now, if someone is eating plenty of fish, it may not be providing much additional benefit, but there is very good, strong evidence that it's not just thinning the blood, it looks like it prevents fatal cardiac arrhythmia. So it looks like, I think that is something, and it actually makes a good this is an important point. That
together with E, is there a risk there, I think Roger's asking, or not?
I don't think the evidence of risk is there, but I think the basic point, as he mentioned, is this is something, whatever you are taking, it is good to share with your important to share with your physician or other health care provider.
Tommy, there could be a problem, he's asking on that one. I'm sorry, our time is so short, but East Brunswick, New Jersey. Tommy, you're on.
Yes, hi. My question, I drink 3 quarts of triple X vitamin water. It has pomegranate, acai, and blueberry a day. I don't take a multivitamin.
Yep.
I'm 60 years old, and it lowered my cholesterol, like from the bad cholesterol, from like 183 to 113.
And you think the drink did that?
My question is,
did that
enter any harm in that?
Any harm in that? Marion Nestle, 3 quarts a day of XXX vitamin water. His cholesterol's
well, it's
down.
Not something that I would recommend, but the if it's having this effect and if he's improving his cholesterol, I suppose it's okay.
Maybe he's eating less because of all that water.
He's certainly going to the bathroom a lot, I would imagine.
Yeah,
but I'm not so concerned about the harm that's caused by these things, especially if they're not consumed in enormous quantities. As much as I am, why would you want your calories that way?
What about children and multivitamins? We've got a listener asking here, Marion. What do you say? Awful lot of those once a day down the hatch in this country.
Fine. You know, if somebody's doing that, just not in too big quantities.
Walter Willett, what about kids and the multivitamin?
If they are eating a really good diet, it's probably not going to do them a whole lot of good, except the vitamin D, to go back to that, is really important. The American Academy of Pediatrics has upped their suggestions to 600 IUs a day of vitamin D, and I think that's very, very, very much within the safe range. And so I think it is, I think Marianne is saying, too, that multiple vitamin per day is can be reasonable. It does provide you with some safety net, and if you're going to have it, though, make sure it has an adequate amount of vitamin D. I think for adults that should be 1,000 or 2,000.
But to her point of good food first, I hope there's so little we're lining up exactly on here, but I hope you'll line up on that.
Of course, good food first, but it can't fill in all the gaps. Again, vitamin D, B12 in older people, and Marion's not quite right there. There's evidence of low blood levels of vitamin B12 in older American population, and also evidence that supplements with B12 and folate can improve cognitive function, and that's pretty important.
Well, it sounds as though we're going to have to continue to hack our way through the underbrush of reports here. You hear from Walter Willett, Harvard School of Public Health, that support for the particular supplements he mentions, and Marion Nestle, who says, have a good diet above all. Sounds like good advice.
And get out in the sun once in a while.
But not too much. Marion Nestle at New York University, blogging at foodpolitics.com. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Pleasure.
Walter Willett at Harvard School of Public Health, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
In a moment, a new recommendation that boys get the HPV vaccine. This is On Point. A committee at the Centers for Disease Control announced this week that boys and even young men should be vaccinated against the human papillomavirus, also known as HPV, which can be transmitted during sexual activity and can lead to cancer. In 2006, the same committee recommended the vaccine for girls. The new recommendation is getting a lot of attention, raising a lot of questions. Joining me now from Nashville, Tennessee, is William Schaffner, chair of the Department of Preventive Medicine at Vanderbilt University School of Medicine. He was a non-voting member of the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices at the CDC that made the recommendation to give boys and young men the HPV vaccine. William Schaffner, welcome back to On Point. Thanks so much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Good to be with you.
So take us back here. Just first of all, what is HPV? We'll get into girls and boys and all this, but what is it and how does it get transmitted generally?
Yeah, HPV stands for human papilloma virus, and it's a virus that's transmitted between boys and girls, men and women, intimately, sexually. And the important thing is that it's a precursor to cancer. If you can prevent the virus infection, you can prevent the cancers. The cancer that's gotten the most attention is cancer of the cervix in women, but it also causes cancers of the vagina and the anus and the penis, and interestingly enough, cancers of the head and neck in both men and women.
Head and neck, because we've got oral sex in this world as well.
Exactly.
Take us back to 2006. It was only recommended then for girls. Now for boys as well. Why was it only recommended for girls in the first place?
It was recommended for girls in the first place because most of the data at that time focused on cancer of the cervix, and the idea was that we would start gradually. Now, clearly, if you'd like to prevent the girl's infection, you want to prevent the boy's infection also, but it was thought that that was not a cost-effective strategy if we vaccinated a very, very large proportion of the girls. Now, what's happened is two things, really. One, that we have not vaccinated the girls as comprehensively as we would like.
Where does that portion stand, Dr. Schaffman?
So at the moment, we're vaccinating young girls starting about age 11, and the first dose, it's a three-dose series, is given to about 45 to 50% of the girls, but okay. Only about a quarter of the girls complete the entire three-dose series. So we're not doing very well.
Does it do any good if you only get one or two of the three-dose series?
Not as much. And the duration of protection is going to be less.
What's the vulnerability of an unvaccinated girl or woman versus a vaccinated girl or woman to the cancer threats?
Over the course of our lifetime, somewhere between, depends on the study, about half to about 70% of women will become infected at some point. But of course, not
with
everyone
HPV.
Mm-hmm. With HPV. But of course, only a minority of those women will go on to develop cancer of the cervix, and that's, of course, the disease that we're trying to prevent.
Take that. Let's say it's half infected at some point. What kind of minority would be at risk then if, that would actually get cervical cancer?
So we currently, with all of our cervical cancer screening programs, mm-hmm. have between 7 and 10,000 cases of cancer of the cervix in the United States today. But by...
That sounds like a pretty small risk.
Yes, but it is cancer, and cancer is nasty,
and we can
prevent 70% of those cancers of the cervix with the vaccine.
So a lot of young women, girls, still are not getting this vaccination, so your committee turns back to look at boys and give us your thought process that led to this recommendation.
So three strains of thinking. Since the girls are not being infected, all of a sudden it becomes cost-effective to vaccinate the boys. Mm-hmm. Number two, this vaccine prevents also genital warts, which are very important on the boys' side of the equation. And since 2006, we have all this information that HPV, the virus, is a precursor to cancers of the head and neck, and those cancers are increasing in this country. And all of a sudden, we have more reasons now to vaccinate the boys as well as the girls. And then the pediatricians tell us, oh, thank goodness you're doing both, because that'll be easier in general practice as we talk to parents.
Just to give it to everyone without gender discrimination.
Exactly.
That is, give it if they put their hand up for it. You have to ask for this, right? This isn't something that's just going to happen without you knowing.
Oh, of course.
Right.
It won't happen without your knowing. But it is, of course, something that is discussed between the pediatrician and the family doctor and the parents.
At what age would boys get the vaccination? Is it the same as for girls? Is it the same three-round cycle?
Same. Starts at the same time, requires three doses quite comparably.
What ages is that? When's the ideal window?
Starts at about age 11, 12, 13. That's the pre-adolescent-adolescent visit. That's routine in which all the vaccinations are reviewed, and so you introduce this vaccination at that time. Of course, they have to come back for the second and third dose. And for the boys, it goes up to about age 21.
But I'm looking here at a report. This is New York Times says may be given to men between the ages of 22 and 26. As late as that?
As late as that, it's not quite as compelling for the guys at that age.
Why? Because they may already have contracted HPV? Or
that's correct. And then we get into the weeds with cost-effectiveness analyses, and it becomes less cost-effective the later you immunize.
When you have the virus, do you have it for life, or does it go away, or both?
Fortunately, in the majority of instances, you get rid of the virus. Some people
just
carry
naturally.
It, yes, quite mm-hmm. naturally. The mm-hmm. body just rids itself, but mm-hmm. some people carry it chronically. And of course, we can't pick out those people in advance. And so the strategy is, if we're going to eliminate these cancers, let's vaccinate everyone.
The Times report also says the burden of disease in males results mostly from oral and anal sex. Does that mean that this is partly about sexuality and you know, whether you're going to have male-female or male-male sex?
So two things. This is undoubtedly the way the virus is transmitted. But what we're trying to prevent is cancer, and we ought to focus on this as a cancer prevention measure and try to take it away somewhat from this whole area of sexuality. But I will tell you in all honesty, that's what gets parents a little nervous. You know, fathers think about their daughter's sexuality beginning about age 38 or somewhere.
But boys, earlier, what about the pickup rate that you're anticipating from American boys? Do you think it'll be higher than the third or so you're seeing among young women, girls?
It's gradual. And just as the immunization of girls is increasing gradually, we anticipate a gradual uptake. There will be the pediatrician family doctor leaders who are big advocates. Then there will be the large group of following physicians and the parents whom they deal with. And then there'll be the folks in the caboose in the train who come along a little later.
Significant risks with this or not, with the HPV vaccine?
Tom, it's a wonderfully safe vaccine. It's a bit of an ouchy vaccine when you get it.
Swelling or something, you mean, or volume?
Pain. It's mostly pain on inoculation.
Okay.
And then you have to be careful. As with any inoculation with a teenager or a pre-teenager, you have to have them sitting down. You have to have them. You have to watch them, because even if you take a blood test from them, they have a tendency to keel over.
Don't keel over. If we got more or all American young people to have this vaccination, what would the upside be, Doctor?
Oh, the upside would be that 70% of cases of cervical cancer, the vast majority of genital warts, and many, many cancers of the head and neck would simply not occur.
William Schaffner, chair of the Department of Preventive Medicine at Vanderbilt University School of Medicine, with us there from Nashville. William Schaffner, thank you, as always, for being with us.
A great pleasure, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.